tables as we were this morning. Well, so we want a couple youngerish people at each table, if possible. And if you have more than a couple youngerish people at, if you need at least, if you don't have any youngerish people, anybody under 20 at your table, if you raise your hand and maybe we can, yeah, except for that one doesn't, yeah. Anybody else? We need a youngerish person over here. Can one of you, one of the Coopers, go over here? But you're still youngerish. Thank you. Everybody else got at least one youngerish? Okay. Well, thank you for... We're pretty much on schedule for EP time, so thank you for... Some people actually may be over sitting in a workshop room wondering why no one's there, because if you're an old-time EP person, we always, I think every year we've ever done this, we've had workshops before lunch, workshops after lunch. So for those of you who this is your first time, you didn't know how unconventional this was. But we did it for a reason, and the reason is because the two congregations we're going to hear from, we thought that you... Some of you would like to hear more about some of their practices, but you wouldn't know you wanted to hear more about their practices until after you heard them. And so that's why we've moved the second workshop session to after this session, so that if you do want to hear more from either Hopwood or Redeemer, it makes it really easy for you, the workshop session, because those will be in here. The Redeemer folks will be down at this end for the next workshop session, and the Hopwood folks will be at this end after that session. And I should mention, because I'll forget, when you move to workshop sessions this afternoon that are back in the DePaul Center, the rooms have changed, and so make sure you're checking your schedule. So don't think that just because you saw a particular workshop in a particular room this morning that it's there this afternoon. Chances are it's not. Okay, so make sure you look on your schedule to see which room you're going to in the DePaul Center. Okay? All right, come on in. So we realize that, as I mentioned in the introduction, that there are things that we'd like to hear. One of the things that we love doing at the Ecclesia Project, if you're new, is hearing from congregations and about their life. And one, it's inspiring, it's encouraging, it's hopeful. And they're our friends, and we love hearing about their lives. But we have always been clear over these years that we've never wanted to hold up any congregation and say, you know, go thou and do likewise, right? We know it just doesn't work that way, which is why I mentioned the other day, this isn't best practices, right? These are minimally decent practices. And so we have two congregations that have been involved with EP from early on. The first congregation is from San Francisco. It's Redeemer Community Church. And they are a sister congregation of Grace, that many of you have heard about. These are both San Francisco. We have many of our friends, EP friends from San Francisco. Sojourners is also in San Francisco. These people have become very dear to us over the years, and we're very grateful for their being here. So we're going to hear from a couple of youth, and from Cindy Fong is going to lead off. And Juliet Chen is going to interview her, some young people, and they're going to interview each other, actually, is sort of how it's going to go. And they're going to go about 25 or 30 minutes, and then we'll switch scenes, and we'll have the Hopwood folks from East Tennessee come up, and they'll do the same thing. Ben Lee will do that. One of the wonderful things about being part of the Ecclesia Project over the years is that you get to introduce one set of your friends to other sets of your friends, right? And so I have lots of people in East Tennessee who've never met my San Francisco friends. And I have San Francisco friends who have become dear to me, they've welcomed me into their home, into their congregation on the West Coast, and I've come to love them. But they don't know my folks back in East Tennessee. And so one of the wonderful things about having Hopwood and Redeemer here, even though I'm not a member of Hopwood, I know a lot of the Hopwood folks, and they're dear to me too, is to be able to get them in the same room so that they get to know each other. So you know the joy of getting longtime friends together and say, you need to know each other because you're both are dear to at least me and to many people here. So that's part of what we're doing today, is getting some folks together and giving you a chance to hear a little bit about what their life together, what, quote, ministering to youth looks like. So I'll just tell you very quickly what we've asked them to do and then what you're going to do, because you have a part to play in this too. We've asked them to start off by telling us just a little bit about their congregation, give you a little context so you can get that in your mind, and also if there's a sort of range of practices that they're involved in, that youth are engaged in, call it a bucket of practices if you want. And then we've asked them to sort of talk a little bit more specifically about one of those, or to talk about their life in conversation with their youth. And so they're going to sort of interview each other about this. And then after about an hour, 30 minutes each, we're going to go to table conversations. And most of your tables should have a facilitator that we've asked to lead. And if you're a facilitator and you don't have your facilitating handout, you can raise your hand and Jenny will give it to you if you didn't get a chance to run it off. Do we have a facilitator here who needs the instructions? If so, just raise your hand. Okay. If it turns out that we have a table that doesn't have a facilitator yet, we'll figure that out in just a minute. But we'll wait till everybody gets here first. So if the Redeemer folks want to come up, we'll let them get started. I think those are all turned on, I think.
That we needed to make. Were we going to receive these children as a gift that would form us to be like Christ? Or did we see them as a hindrance to what the Lord was calling us to be and need to find some way to kind of set that aside so we could be whatever the church God was calling us to be? And by God's grace, we chose, not without difficulty, it actually was not a straightforward process and it was difficult, to receive our children as a gift. That in receiving them, we were receiving Christ, and that we were have become more like him, I hope, and have welcomed him by welcoming them. So let me just give you one of our convictions and some practices that come out of that. I'm going to hear more in the workshop. But one of them is that children and youth are members of the body of Christ and able to practice their membership and worship and participation in the whole life of the church. So we are, okay, let me see if I can get that word right. No, I can't. We baptize infants. That, I know it's not credo, but I don't know. That one. Okay, that's what we are. And when we do this, there's a litany that we rehearse where we say, you are not your own. We have been, the Grace Fellowship actually shared with me, their pastor wrote this. You've been bought at a price. So we rehearse when they're baptized that they are not their own, they've been claimed by God. And so therefore we as a congregation claim them as our own. We are the body of Christ. And so the parents and the congregation together commit to raise those babies up to know that they have been claimed by God since birth, before then actually. And a lot of our practices actually flow out of this practice. And so the next practice does is we see children as full participants in worship. So our kids start coming to our worship service around age 3, and they stay up until the sermon at that point. And then when they enter kindergarten, they are then part of the whole worship service. And we very much believe that children can worship, that they can hear from God in the sermon, that they can, we serve them communion, and believe they can receive from Christ in communion, in the passing of the peace, they can give what they have in the offering. So we view them as full participants in our worship services. Another practice that flows out of this is youth, 6th grade and up, participate and really are needed in all aspects of the life of our congregation. We meet each Wednesday night. We do a range of things. We study books. We do lectio. We have Bible study. We'll have discussions about the life of our congregation. And 6th grade and up are fully part of those conversations. We expect we'll hear from the Lord through them and that they will hear from the Lord through us. And the way we've done those has shifted over the years with more young people that we have in that setting. You serve in all areas of our church. They're ushers. They're half of our worship band. They run our sound system. They pray and read scripture and worship. I can go on, but I only have 6 minutes. And so they just ran half of our week-long camp that we had for elementary school kids. We would not be who we are as Redeemer Community Church without our young people. We would be a different congregation. And also, everyone from 6th grade and up who's able and willing to serve in child care, child care is definitely a ministry that allows adults to have conversation and worship, but we actually see this more than that. We see child care as a ministry that allows our children to know one another and to know intergenerationally everybody in the church and to know that they belong to us. That's just one way to do it. There's a bunch of, but one of the comments that people will make when they come to us is that we don't know whose kid belongs to who, that we can't figure that out. And so I see that as a sign. In a workshop earlier, maybe a miracle, though. My son leaned over to me like, really, that's a miracle? But anyway, it's a work of Christ. Immersion is a word that we use a lot when we talk about the formation of young people. That may be because we have several families that have had kids go through Spanish immersion school, where they're immersed in the language and culture, and that's how they learn it. We definitely believe that culture has a lot of language and stories that they're giving and trying to form our youth from, and we really want our young people to be fully immersed in the people of God and the Word of God. And I've just shared a few ways to do that. There's other ways. There's a curriculum that we've received from Grace Fellowship. But anyway, those are the things you can hear about in the workshop. We're going to turn over to the end of
the
room now.
So, we're preparing for this. We had such a great conversation. I really enjoyed it, so I'm glad that we get to share your stories with everyone. And you two represent kind of not been our church, but James, you have grown up the church with your family, and Melissa, you've grown up in our church without your family, and so that brings different stories out. Could you guys share, and maybe James first, so but same question for both of you. When or how did you first realize that you were a member of Reading Room?
And so, actually, I grew up in the church. Both my parents are Christian, and not only going to a church every Sunday and Wednesday, but going to a Christian school. I was in an environment where I was surrounded by Christians. And so, very much brought into that, I was baptized as an infant. And even though I wasn't baptized at our church, I wasn't going to our church at that point, I very much identify with the litany of the church committed to raising this child. And so, in one sense, I felt raised by the church, and every time we affirmed that baptismal litany, that child is not his own, he's bought at a price. The child is not his own, he belongs to the church. I felt that in the church. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I heard a lot of stories of people being in the church, kind of going through the works, and I guess that's true in a lot of ways I did, right? But you might be expecting me to say that I never really participated in it or knew it, and I'm just now kind of waking up to it. But that's not necessarily the case. I think it's more a story of continually following God in the community of the church, failing at so many points, and drawing closer and further from God. But a story of really participating in the church and having a chance to reaffirm that in my community in the practice of confirmation. And it's kind of like, I guess, comparable for us to, in some ways, like the marriage covenant, which I don't tend to know anything about. But just that you're committing yourself to the work of the church and its life and its ministry. And I felt that before I went off to college, one of the practices that we do at confirmation is the adults share about ways they see God at work in the children and the youth. They were very intent on doing that in my life, and I think in Melissa's when she got confirmed as well. And so obviously God's work is not done in us, and that's just the beginning. So it wasn't so much of a graduation as a, all right, we're just getting started. Welcome to the life of the church, and we recognize you as that. And it's sort of in the presence of God and the presence of the church, what you're committing yourself to.
Yeah, so technically I was baptized and became a member when I was around 14. I was going into my freshman year in high school, but I just felt I've always been a member of Redeemer just because I've grown up in Redeemer ever since that we were planted by grace. And I just felt so involved in the church already. Asked to serve in many different ways, like to usher during our service, or to lead our Thanksgiving prayer, or serve in child care, or serve in the university camp. I was always really involved in the church, even though my parents didn't go to meet about my sister and my younger sister. So even it just seemed natural and right for me to be baptized and become a member. But at that time, I think I really understood what I was going through when I was going through baptism and membership classes. I really wanted to get baptized as well because my older sister got baptized when she was 14, so it felt like a time for me, and I followed her footsteps. But baptism to me at that time felt like it was my time to choose into this faith, that it was me choosing to follow Jesus, and that was for me to decide. But going through membership process, I was talking with our pastor, Danny, and another member from our church. And I was telling them that, yeah, I feel like I want to be baptized and I want to become a member because I've been here and I want to follow Jesus and I don't want to choose this. But our other fellow member, Sylvia, she kind of reminded me that, yes, I'm choosing into this, but Christ has already chosen to be part of his people. And so baptism was that point. I thought through baptism, and when I got that water on my head, that everything when I was a sixth grader, that was when I started attending Wednesday Bible study. Before that, I was just in a child care, and it was a fun time for me to hang out with people during my Wednesday nights. But although that's weird that you came to child care, right? But yeah, you didn't have to come to child care, but you came to be with us. Yeah, so that's cool. Yeah, definitely. So having that transition from going to child care and then attending Wednesday Bible study was pretty good for me. I think especially because that was when I really read the Bible, or I had a time to read the Bible, and I think I was more capable to enter into the story of Jesus and really understanding who he was and who he is. I mean, we also had a Sunday church school before worship, and we also had sermon times from Dan during the service, but we had a lot of chances to hear about the word, but as I was younger, it was pretty difficult for me to really understand kind of what Danny was saying. I thought, to me, the sermon was kind of a free time for me. I remember the movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was coming out, and I really wanted to read the book before I watched the movie, so I brought the book to church and on Sunday, and I brought it out, and I was trying to read during the sermon. But Susie, she is another member of our church that likes to sit with me and my sister during the sermon. She always said to Susie. Yeah, she sat next to us and kind of watched out for us. She just kind of tapped my shoulder and said, she'll put that away and try to listen to it. So even though that time, it was difficult for me to really understand what the Lord was trying to say to me, I think it was also a good time to just be able to sit in that time. Designated time to hear from the Lord, and even if I didn't really understand what's going on throughout the time, it was more comfortable for me. It was a pattern that I got used to and was more comfortable with.
That's great. I like that both of you guys just pretty much saying that you can kind of always tell.
Have a question?
yeah, so I was going into the baptism membership process and kind of having my own idea of what that meant, but what does it really mean to be a member?
So, yeah, if you're like wondering if you're missing something, like some fine print, I don't think there is. I think kind of what you were saying all along, that the way in which you felt like you were a member, I think that is what it meant. That is what it means to be a member or redeemer. That you want to be Christian, that that we are all looking to Jesus and walking together in Him, and trying to figure out together how to be faithful. And it's not some contract or nothing magical necessarily happens, and yet significant that you, both of you being confirmed or baptized and becoming a member, that we can all kind of relax and kind of expand into our expectations of each other and in our pursuit of Christ together.
In our congregation, this has been a process we're growing into. So, for the ones that were oldest, we just invited them to be part of our membership class with other adults. And that's Melissa's case. Also, when we baptize babies, we baptize babies of adult members, which is why Melissa was not baptized, so she was older. James was our first confirmation. We have more of them, and so anyway, just so you know, that process is evolving for us as a youth grow up and trying to pay attention to what's happening and we do, like, one question we talked about, is this just a formality? And I would say no. If not, just it's there is something important that happens, and there's limitations to this, no. analogy, but the analogy of marriage, where you're not married until you're married, right? I mean, you're not married until you actually go through the process of before God commits your life to another. And so we talk about that, that it actually does matter that you stand up in front of the congregation and say, I want to follow Jesus. Who is your Lord and Savior? Jesus is my Lord and Savior. You renounce Satan and all of this is true. Yes, I renounce him. We go through that. It's from the Presbyterian. So that is actually important. And yet it's not like the magical changing moment, but it is, it changes the relationship with the congregation when you said, yeah, we are in covenant relationship with each other. So.
So how has being a part of Redeemer in all these years shaped the way that you think about the rest of your life? I did that super well. This past year was my first year at college, and I went away from home and away from the community at Redeemer. And so coming into college, I was really seeking that, to have a community of believers to continue with my journey and my faith. So I was seeking the fellowship. I jumped around from a lot of different places before I settled with one. It was difficult deciding on one because there's a lot of different aspects of different fellowships, but I think the ones that I really needed coming into college and not knowing very many people was to have that community, and I think I seek that and still seeking that. But also looking for a church community was definitely difficult because I was looking for something similar to Redeemer, but that's pretty difficult to find. The church that I'm kind of regularly attending back here by my college, they're a congregation of mostly elderly people, so that's definitely different from our setting of having a lot of youth and children around. But they do have this mentorship program that I think was really appealing to me because I remember in our youth retreat, I think this year, we started this thing called Gospel Friend Time, where basically we had the youth had one-on-ones with one of the staff leaders, and I don't really know what we were trying to look for that time or what we were supposed to talk about, but I remember I was paired with Cindy, and I really opened up and was able to just talk about anything. I think mostly also about my struggles, which was really helpful to have someone who's wiser than can help me through that. So I really was seeking that in the mentorship program. And so now I have a mentor. She's in her 60s. She's an older, elderly woman, and we meet. Where all you see are people
hobbies in church. And I didn't do it for Juliet, it was encouraging. What you were encouraging us to do was to think of church and Jesus at the center of that, not just as another accessory or auxiliary activity that we participate in, but something that is central to what we do with the rest of our lives. Basically encouraging us to reorder our life around the truth of the gospel. And so I remember that being really important, especially as you're in high school, you're thinking of what you're going to go out and do. And shaping whatever I did as being something that would be vocation or calling, that I could participate in God's plan for me, using the skills and the abilities He's given to serve Him. And so this past year I was in Peru, and kind of like an intermediate year between high school and college, we were doing service work there. And I was with a group of kids from my school, six other kids. One of them was Jewish. We had a lot of really interesting discussions. But one of the things she said about me, and don't get me wrong, I have so much fallen short of what I wanted to do in terms of moving this out. But it was a blessing that she could see me, that she said that my life, it was hard to pick out the different spheres of my life. And she thought that faith is something that was very much integrated in what I did. And I think I can attribute that to people who have modeled that to me in our church, especially very long, decided to kind of come alongside me. I was one of the older youth, and he really befriended me, and modeled that for me, because it takes it from the abstract and puts it into a real human life, not shying away from our weaknesses. I mean, in so many ways, one of them I can tell you I've fallen short, but to see that and to enter into both our communal triumphs and weaknesses, I think is one of the most powerful testimonies to how we can live out faithfully our salvation in the church and in the rest of our lives. So, a question for you guys. How do you guys encourage their commitments and the commitments to Christ and to His body that flow out of His claim on us in the midst of a culture that really is constantly clamoring for their attention?
I don't know. kind of wrong with the answer, right? God's grace and His pursuit is hard to, it's so expansive and creative. But when I think about it, I praise God that your parents, they raise you up so well that since you are so athletic, I know that any number of if your baseball coach or your basketball coach would love to own you in your life. You've been filled with that, but your parents were so clear. You were going to go to Sunday worship and not basketball practice. I think about immersion, as he was saying, both immersion in this large story of God, in all of its beauty and troublesomeness, and all of the questions that it raises and the ways that we enter into the story. The rich inheritance of the saints, the gospel does have to be embodied in a whole community, though, not just one or two adults, but a whole group of adults. I'm really appreciative of our church that we have a congregation that is continually learning and striving to learn what it means to be faithful together, that we are genuinely striving and alive to the Spirit in the world, and that not just that we have those adults in our congregation, but that there's intentionality to share that life and also interpretation. So
wanted that. So, I mean, there has to be a certain, you know, I mean, we can't, that part is God's grace, but we can't make people want the gospel. But if there is a desire in the youth, then lots of room for us to come alongside and interpret it and keep on building a relationship. And then we hope that that relationship becomes like you and Barry's relationship, where it's not just him asking you how he can pray for you, but I know that it goes both ways. I know that you ask him how he can pray for him, and it's a genuine friendship where you guys expect of each other. So,
it's going to be very difficult for me to talk with only one hand, so bear with me. I'm going to be sitting down as well. So, we're from Hopwood Christian Church, Hopwood Memorial Christian Church, but everybody at our congregation just refers to it as Hopwood. And I want to begin by just briefly give you a sketch of the culture of Hopwood. Talking about minimally decent practices, and so I want to categorize maybe three minimally decent practices within kind of an understanding of just the culture of Hopwood. And so one category I would say, just to begin, that most people see right out of the gate is the sort of random ad hoc fellowship that seems to happen, and as a part of the culture, you'll have somebody email the entire congregation saying, "Hey, we're going to go up to our cabin in the mountains, and next to the Appalachian Trail, and if you want to bring a dish, we're going to have the grill open. Come on up and enjoy fellowship. We'll be up there between 11 and midnight." And 80 to 100 people just show up. If you get these people to try to RSVP to anything, it's just not going to happen. You get two people RSVP, and then when the other 100 show up and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't RSVP," it's just maddening sometimes. But it's also good that we don't really have a fellowship committee. I think your mom is technically,
she doesn't really like meetings.
She said, I'll be a part of the fellowship committee if I do not have to come to any meetings and I don't have to give any reports. And we said, done. And so part of that is just the culture of these fellowships sort of come organically. One of the reasons why I think that's minimally important, but important nonetheless, is that our kids, college students, young adults, elders, don't see this as a sort of specialized event. We have events that you do by yourselves, but we also, it's completely open. And so I've got three boys, young boys, between the ages of 8 and 13, and they don't ask, "Why are we doing this?" as if fellowship is one compartment and worship of the church is another compartment. And so that's sort of a joy to see that church is not compartmentalized, and I would say that that would go intergenerationally, which brings to this sort of second conviction and practice that you see throughout. One of the most successive failures that we had to have a college class, other college Sunday school class, other churches in the area do it, so we feel compelled. We better do it, and college students come to our church and they go to these other classes that have the wide variety of generations. They say, I'm with college students all week. I don't want to be with college students yet again on Sunday. And so that's been kind of nice to hear that, sort of reaffirm this notion of integration. Also, another quick story about that to show the core conviction. For whatever reason, we have our children's choir director moved her choir practice time to between 6 and 7 every week, which was fine. But once a month, the church gets together for this big potluck that we call Agape, where we just eat together and pray. And so I was thrilled that I didn't have to watch my three boys, who were sort of like, I don't know if you've seen Despicable Me 2, but when the Minions kind of turn into these creatures where destruction just sort of happens. That's sort of what happens with my boys when they get together with the rest of the kids in the congregation. So for them to be sort of contained was such a pleasure, and I could have a conversation with the adults. This elder, during the elders' meeting, said, I've got a significant issue I need to bring up. And she said, where are the children? We need the children here at the table when we eat. I cannot stand the fact that I no longer see little Morgan and Patrick running around, and I want to lay my hands on them. I want to take them some hugs. And I'm thinking, shut up, please. Why do we believe in integration? So then the elders formally asked, we didn't pontificate, but we said, would you please consider this? And they did, and they're back in the midst. But again, that's a part of the culture. It's not a programmatic thing that we try to push as much as just a conviction that happens. Another practice that I think is pervasive is, and it just sort of happens, partly because we have different people who are gifted in getting things together with regards to service, but we'll have service projects that sort of arise not in a programmatic way, but as we're attentive to different people's needs. In the same way that if one of your friends is pregnant, it's common in a lot of cultures to just assume the responsibility of the show, to throw a baby shower, part of some cultures, right? And it's interesting when certain people go in for surgery, it's expected that their close friend is going to get together a list of how we're going to feed these people. We need for them to not worry about fixing a meal every night. And so that's really fun to see that it's, again, not coming from a programmatic way, but it's a sort of virtue that is just celebrated and encouraged in the church. And I think we encourage each other and hold each other accountable to that. But now I want to shift gears and focus on, let's contextualize that, to focus on one particular practice, and that is the practice of regular worship, which is a thing that sort of popped up in some workshops and even in some of the lectures, the significance of worship in the congregation. So this is multiple cans of worms that I'm just going to open up and just let them crawl out. So I've got to try to, in maybe 5 minutes, share some of my, not just mine, but my assumptions and convictions, as well as several other people involved with cultivating the worship service. How do we think about worship theologically? What are our convictions? What informs our convictions? And so I want to share a little bit about that. First of all, because we're so integrated in these other places, we also have other opportunities to worship where it's a little bit more, I guess you could say, specialized. The youth every Wednesday night, we worship together. That's our main meeting, is a worship service. And I feel that we can get away with it because I truly believe in the virtue of sort of an integrated worship service. And there's other times where we worship with the greater congregation. But then I think there's some virtues to doing it also where we allow the youth to come together and worship in this context. So there's some dangers in that I recognize, but I'm going to just share some of my convictions and how I come to understand this. So one of the things that I wanted to use to kind of highlight this actually came from the quote from Shannon Ross. He quoted Milbank, and he said, "Spectacle is the de-intensification of being." I thought that was a really interesting term of phrase, and one of the convictions that I've had is that worship is then the opposite of that. That in worship, that is the sort of at the heart of the fire of the intensification of being. Partly, if you believe that when we worship, we are, as the body of Christ, actually coming in a very mystical way. We are uniting ourselves with the body of Christ in this way. What are we uniting ourselves to? We are uniting ourselves to this being that we say is fully human and fully divine, right? So just think about that. Like, the intensification of being, it would be intense enough to say, hey, we're going to do this thing where we are going to become fully human. That in and of itself, I think, is intensification enough. And then when we add to it, to participate in a being that's also so divine, you just jack this up a whole heck of a lot, right? And so that really charges me. What does it mean to think about worship as an intensification of being? We're coming into an awareness and you're growing into the likeness of Christ. Another thing that I read recently came, there was this guy who writes about design theory. He has this quote that says, and this is not a guy who thinks about, is not thinking about worship or theology, he's just talking about theory of design. And one of the things that he says is that everyone designs who devises courses of action aimed at changing current situations into preferred ones. Everyone designs who devises courses of actions that is aimed at changing current situations into preferred ones. And this writer, James K. Smith, who you've heard of, he says, if this guy is correct, then the gospel is a design project and worship is a design studio. And I like that. I like to think about worship as a design studio. And so the two things I'll say about that before I enter into a dialogue with these two guys is that, first of all, the design that happens in worship, I think, is a byproduct of the worship itself. So that's a conviction of mine, is that I don't worship in order to be formed. I don't think we should worship in order to be formed in such a way. I think we worship because the good of worshiping is good, right? We open ourselves up to the love of God, and we find that at the core of our being that we ought to love God in return. We actually find our desire for God in opening ourselves up to the love and grace of God. And we come to that realization just that itself is good. And so I don't want to receive the love of God and love God in return so that I can become a better person, per se. I used to wrestle in high school, and I loved the act of wrestling. But wrestling also got me in great shape. It made me have a healthy diet, and it made me stronger. But I didn't wrestle to get in shape. I didn't wrestle to lose weight or to get stronger. Those were wonderful byproducts of this activity, but I loved the activity. And I think that should be at the heart of worship. And a question that I think I'm always asking is, how do you help someone else be open to the love of God or the love of another human being, right? How does that happen? And how do we help each other come to receive the love of God, the grace of God? These are pretty big questions. And to see worship as the primary place in which that happens. So how do I answer the question then? Some of these questions, how do we design worship, so to speak? Even if you are from a tradition that is heavily liturgical, I'd say like the Orthodox Church, they do not have much. I've got several Orthodox friends, so I'd say this. to ad-libbing the divine liturgy of Chrysostom, right? That's just not something that's on the radar. However, there's other things that they do think about, right? They think about the icons, the arrangement of the icons. There's certain icons that they put in certain places, but then there's also which icons are we going to put up? Which icons are we going to arrange in certain places? How are we going to enter into this space? There's certain cultures of some Orthodox churches. There's just certain expectations of how you enter the space, and others have other expectations, right? So even within a tradition that's sort of really sort of off the cuff, say, oh, they're extremely rigid, even in a tradition like that, there's lots of flexibility. There's lots of questions to be answered. There's lots of decisions to be made that have to do with the context of worship. So how do I, what informs mine as well as some of the other leaders in our congregation about worship? And I'll just briefly say, what has shaped me is the liturgy of the church, and looking at the broad spectrum of the different historical traditions, what they all have in common, what they see, the voices that seem to have, the themes that seem to reoccur over and over again have been profoundly formative to me. And so that in turn, because I've been so shaped by that. And by the way, I'm not from a tradition. The Christian churches are not historically, liturgically grounded. We are in our own liturgy, which is a liturgy that we believe is no liturgy. But that's our liturgy. But at least it's handed down from us, but we're growing. So that's one of the things I looked at, to the liturgical traditions. And sometimes just being informed by that helps me ask the right questions. Questions that I didn't even think were questions. Actions that I didn't even think were courses of actions that I needed to be concerned about. Like, how do you enter a space? I used to think, well, you just walk on in and shoot off the flare gun and say, let's get started, right? But then liturgical tradition helps me just pause and say, what questions can I ask that will lead me into this ultimate vision of what I think we're doing here? So with that, hopefully I can expound on that a little bit more with some of these questions. But my first question is going to go to Daniel Cooper. Daniel and I have very similar upbringings when you look at just from birth to about high school. And it's a more evangelical tradition, youth groups that draw upon, which is also been referenced, the industry of youth ministry, especially the praise and worship song, which I'm not knocking at all, some of those are very formative to me. But nevertheless, that was my only understanding of worship, which usually loud band for 15 minutes and one slow song to transition into a 15-minute message and a prayer to be done. Some fast song at the end. And no fast song to leave us out on, yeah. I had a sort of slow movement into what it means to worship in a way that's connected with this broader tradition, I should say. So in many ways, our youth group worship had already, had been cultivated in such a way, he just sort of entered into that from that perspective. So the first question I'm going to ask, and I'm going to ask Grace here, a similar question that she was sort of born and raised in this context, so her perspective can be a little bit different, but what was one of the first things that you noticed coming from that? He was a junior, I think you were a junior in high school?
I think so. I forgot what she was.
What were some of the things you noticed coming into a context that we weren't saying this is why we're doing everything? We just sort of did it in a lot of ways. What were some of the things that you noticed coming from a tradition like that?
So I came to Hopwood actually because of my dad, who was friends with David Butsu, whom some of you know, I believe, is kind of part of this conference, and it was actually him that was my first connection to the youth group. So I would come and then stay afterward and talk with Ben and David, both just about theology, which was a natural extension of the worship experience itself. That this was sort of a natural. We would talk about things that we were doing in worship, and I guess the impression that I got for first impression that I had over a couple of weeks. This wasn't like my first thought as I walked in the door, but one of the first impressions I had was that it was really okay to think and to use your brain to worship God, which was something that I had not really experienced. In the, you mentioned how you start this thing, you just come in and pop a flare gun, which is actually how I had entered youth group for years. Was not a literal flare gun, but let's get excited, we're going to do a loud band, and then we're going to have a little talk, and then we're going to play some games and have an ice cream sundae thing or whatever, and then go home at the end of the night. And so to have this thing that was really different than that, it was like, we've come here to really do some work. And you gotta have your brain turned on. It's not just this sort of fluffy, like, oh, makes you feel good inside, inspires you for the night, and then you go home inspired to do better, and then you forget when you sleep.
One of the things that I think about when we have, in the section of the kind of a normal liturgical service, especially a liturgy of a word, I should say, is you have the reading of the gospel, right? After reading the gospel is usually a homily. In that section, I usually have about 15 minutes where it's very dialectical, and while I think there's a lot of positives, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that I can learn from education theory of why it's good to not simply lecture. One of the other things that's informing that is I believe that in the church we learn how to talk about God appropriately, and one of the ways that I think kids who are coming from sixth grade, sort of right at the cusp of adolescence, through adolescence, and then just outside of adolescence, before all that, they can't even think abstract thoughts, right? Think very concrete. And when you consider how much of our faith is metaphor, it's just an army of metaphor and symbol, right? And then this is the phase where we can't just assume they get the connections. And we can't just assume that they have the capacity to respond to these questions. That was something that was raised, I guess, in the documentary, was some of these kids have never just been asked questions about their faith. And so to use the context of worship to then raise some of the questions and to really push them, like riding a bike, to give them an opportunity to talk on their own and to not, you know, feel ashamed about exploring their faith or, you know, not saying the right thing, but at the same time hold them accountable and not saying, hey, you can say whatever you want, you know, there's no bad answers. But to really kind of gently incorporate that so that we can learn how to talk about God appropriately. This one of the, I guess, forming assumptions that apply to that, not just is it effective, hopefully, but also the importance of learning in that context. To Grace, also someone who born raised in a, you know, little Church of Christ non-instrumental, which means you love singing hymns and you're used to worshiping hard, and you're really used to assuming that you have to learn things in order to worship. But and then coming to Hopwood and seeing your older brother be involved in different aspects of your worship life, and then kind of slowly growing into that as a sixth grader, can you remember what would, in the eyes of a sixth grader, what were some of the things that you, what did they notice? What did you notice as a sixth grader in some of the ways in which you worship?
I think for me, it was new how intimate it was, because we worship in a big room that I spent a lot of time in my whole life growing up. We do children's church activities down there, and the games, and the camps. But on Wednesday nights, we turn some of the lights off, and we gather chairs in a small circle, and we put up dividers to make the room seem smaller. And just what we do through worship really makes it an intimate experience. And you grow very close to the people that you're worshiping with, and you grow closer to God through that. And we go to a fairly small church, but I think it was new and a little bit strange and a little bit exciting.
And again, that was something I referenced before of believing that space matters and things matter. And I didn't think about that before being formed and taught by the traditions that all of this, all the physical things matter. It's not just functional. We can think functionally as well as theologically, and so that was something that I'm trying to be mindful of. And there's always ways to, in order to attain that goal, there's some flexibility about what do we do, but I think the traditions help us know what the parameters are, you know, where should we put the focus here, that's interesting that you noticed. In some ways, by the time you were in youth group, it was not something, that, at times, it becomes so second nature that you don't realize the importance of space. There's other physical things that I'm paying attention to, but just even the shape of the room and how the shape of the room, I mean, people who are building cathedrals made high ceilings for the act of turning one's gaze heavenward, right? Well, if architects think that way, that's somewhat theological. How can we talk about entering a room? Entering is worshiping together in a way that our attention goes to the appropriate things.
What I mentioned earlier, that I was going to interrupt you, that was what I was going to say. So it's just that, coming from my last thing that I just said, which was we're allowed to think in church, it seems almost ironic that it was amazing to me how embodied that worship was. That you're using your brain in a way that most youth groups that I've been a part of had not used their brains. But at the same time, they were almost in this sort of Gnostic kind of world of it's all about kind of how you feel and whether you believe in your head and all these different things. Where there really is a huge impact that the space has, or that the posture has, and maybe I'm going to go on that one too, but even our physical posture, standing, sitting, kneeling, dancing, doing different things with our bodies that all really, really matter.
Okay. To reinterrupt you, then. Steal my thunder.
There. Sorry about that.
Listen,
go ahead.
That's good. That was another observation I thought was interesting, that I thought growing up that my youth group was really utilized multimedia. And then I started thinking about that. We have a screen and audio, right? And that was multimedia. And then I started looking at some of the traditions where we use no sense of, in our worship, no sense of feeling, nothing tactile. We would raise our hands, and so there was some range of motion in worship, but I think our liturgical tradition opens our minds and opens us up to the whole possibility of the full range of motion that I think we can incorporate into worship in a very powerful way. So it's truly multimedia. We're using all of the senses we're using. It's not just the audio and video. That's a definite sort of virtue. But then again, what's the right way to use that? You know, do you do it just to get kids attention? There's always going to be, every time you have a certain action, there's always going to be a danger with that action. So it's always going to be easy to fall into the trap, which leads to my next question, I guess, fall into the trap of, am I doing this just because it's cool or neat? You know, how much am I playing off of that? I want it to be interesting and engaging, but at the same time, I don't want to do it for the sake of it just being interesting, right? I want us to kind of orient our attention to God and to use it that way, and not simply as doing something new or novel. Do we have time for one question, one more question? Or are we done? I was going to ask one more.
Yeah, one more time.
One more time? Short question. Short, yes, sure. In what way do you find some of the things that happen in worship that kind of stick with you to where worship, things that we do in worship sort of spill out, maybe even contextualize the rest of your life or other aspects of life?
In one way, I think David Weeks, who our worship minister, he always says that singing is like praying, acceptable. And so I find myself singing songs all the time because I love just the message, but just the rhythm, seeing the music, and I sing it to myself in the car. My favorite passage of the Bible is Magnificat, Canon of Mary. And we sing Magnificat song every week. Really reiterates.
Same one yesterday.
We did sing one yesterday. It's very exciting for me. But just reiterates that, and I think it's a good way to look at the world and see the world, and so our worship reiterates that. And it, because I've sung these songs so many times, when I lead worship, actually thinking about that.
Continues to teach and inform. Yeah. The last thing I'll say, and we'll share your comment, continues to teach. We took a trip out to Grandfather Mountain, you remember this time? And there's these sections where you can kind of, these little paths that lead you into these really cool valleys where you've got these outcrop rocks, and there's one time where I'm on one side of this mountain and about maybe 400 yards away down the valley up on this other side of this valley, Tyler had run around and he was up there and he was waving his hands and they were like, yeah! And it was like, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? And he yells out, and some of you know the Venite, which is Psalm 95, I think, which is something that we sing a lot in, or chant. We actually bring in a little bit of chant into the, if you're, and he goes, come let us sing to the Lord. And he pauses and we go, me and my friend were like, let us shout for joy to the rock of our salvation. And then in that psalm is, in his hands are the caverns of the earth and the heights of the hills are his also. That's part of the psalm. It's buried in the middle of the psalm. But to think that we're out just having a good time, hanging out, and to think that worship is contextualizing, this is just a random adventure that we're on. And to think that what is going to contextualize and make meaning of this situation, and what is my natural reaction to my friends that I see on the other side? Oh, that's what it's called, the Psalms. And I'm going to scream the Psalms from the heights of the hills, right? That's it. That's fantastic. And that's just, again, that's a byproduct of the formation of worship, that it enables us to live life well, to live life with beauty, so that, as the other psalmist says, that we become such a people, such a kingdom, that people can walk around us, as the psalm says, walk around the city of God, consider its towers and its ramparts, that you may tell the next generation, such is our God, right? And for us to live such lives that have been formed by worship and these other practices, that people can look to us and say, such is their God, right? Why would we not want our lives to be saturated in this kingdom? Thank you.
Adjusting schedule just a little bit. We know we're running a little late, but that's good. At least we have good stuff going on. We still want to have some table conversation. If you're one of my facilitators, raise your hand so I can see which tables don't have a facilitator. Okay, if you've got two of you at the same table, if you'll go to a table that doesn't have a hand up, that would be good. So, hold them up. Keep your hand, if you're a facilitator, keep your hand up so I can see. So we got Joe there. Yes.
I'm not a facilitator, but I can.
Okay. Is there a table that doesn't have one? I'm having a hard time spotting. Everybody got a facilitator? Person with the paper? Okay. So we're going to adjust this to about 25 minutes instead of 30, which means we're going to run about 15 minutes late to the workshops, and we'll just kind of adjust. Okay? We've got about a half an hour break. The good thing about it is you're going back to the student center for the workshops, most of you, and that's where we're having dinner. Right? So you're in the building that you're having dinner. So that'll work for most of you, I know. There's other things to do. So thanks again to both of the congregations, so Redeemer and Hopwood. What we want to give you now is a chance to think about your own formation and how formation happens in your own congregations or congregations that have been formative for you or what you're involved in now. And so, and we want to do this a little bit more structured than we sometimes do about discussions. So we're going to do a couple of sort of a three-minute exercise and then a two-minute exercise, and the person at your table is going to explain what that is. But we're going to try to do that together, because the second two-minute exercise is silence, and it's hard to do that if we're not all doing that together. Okay? So we're going to kind of keep the first 5 minutes together, and then your facilitator is going to take over at your table. Okay? And you'll be done when you're done. Okay? And then you can start moving to the workshop. Actually, you shouldn't do that, because I know there's going to be a couple of announcements that I think John's going to make at that time. So we're aiming to be done at about almost quarter after. Okay? All right. So go ahead, facilitators, take it away with the first 3 minute exercise there. Hopefully you've heard from someone, a youngish person or two from your table. And now we're inviting all of you to be thinking for the next 2 minutes in silence. What practices were formative for yourself, either when you were a young person? And you think if you were a person who grew up in the church, what experiences were most formative for you, looking back on it, best you can tell? Or if you didn't grow up in the church and you're part of a particular congregation now or recently that you sense is probably formative for you, we're going to take 2 minutes in silence and just have you sort of focus on one or two of those practices that were formative for you. And then you're going to be sharing that with someone else. But just in silence for 2 minutes. Take some time to think about that, all of us. Okay, and now you're going to be, for the next 2 minutes, you're going to be splitting up into pairs at your table, and you're going to take each person in the pair is going to take 1 minute to tell your pair, okay, your person in your pair, what you were reflecting on. Now, when you come back to the full table group after those 2 minutes, you're going to report on what that person said. So be paying attention. Okay. Right? You have to take notes, do that. It's okay. All right? So take 2 minutes, 1 minute each, to tell the other person what you were thinking about. Thank you. or something. So I'm getting ready to hand it off to the table facilitators here. But now you're going to take the time in about 30 to 60 seconds each around the table to report on what that person told you so everybody around the table can hear. Okay, and now table facilitators, it's yours from here on else. We got 15 minutes to finish what you have to do. Okay, go ahead. Thank you.